Paul returned to Jerusalem and was urged to go into the temple to pay for the ending of a vow of three Jewish believers. And everything was going okay until the point where he was recognized by some of the Jews who had chased him through Asia. And now they were there in Jerusalem and they recognized him and they caused quite a ruckus. Quite a ruckus. And they wound up that in order to preserve Paul's life, the Romans grabbed him, took him back to the fortress of Antonia, and there figured out that Paul was a Roman citizen. Uh-oh, because they had put him in chains. But in a sense, Paul was in protective custody. And the Romans, these pagans, these eclectic, inclusive pagans, could not for the life of them figure out what all this ruckus was about. Because as far as they were concerned, one God's as good as another. You find an interesting God, you stick him in your pantheon and you move on. So what all of this almost coming to blows, in fact coming to blows, I can't say almost, of beating Paul up and all the rest of it, they're absolutely close as to what was going on. So the commander said, "All right, I got an idea. I'm going to take this guy back to the Sanhedrin. We're going to convene right here in the fortress, and we're going to figure out right now what's going on. We're going to ask some questions. We're going to figure out who this guy is and what kind of trouble he's in that's causing all the Jewish authorities to go berserk." So in Acts chapter 23, verse 1, Paul is standing before the council. Now, mind you, in some sense, they have no authority over him because he's a Roman citizen in a Roman fortress with Roman soldiers all around. But in another sense, the Roman authorities wanted to really be on the good side of the Jewish ruling council. So they did have some concern about what the council thought. So Acts chapter 23, starting in verse 1. Paul, looking intently at the council, said, "Brethren," he calls them brethren. He desires to start off on a friendly note. "I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." Well, okay, what does he mean by that? Does he mean that he was righteous before God when he was locking believers up and causing trouble in all kinds of communities of believers? Does that mean that was the right thing to do? No. But what Paul is saying is that he thought it was the right thing to do. That his desire in life was to please God and have a good conscience. He didn't go about it the right way. But that was his goal. And his goal, even at that point, when he was standing before the Jewish council, was to continue to have that good conscience. Of course, he's going to do something in a minute that's going to ruin that good conscience, but anyway. Verse 2, "The high priest Ananias commanded those around standing beside him to strike him on the mouth." When they heard that, they said, "We've got to hit that guy." Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you set to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck?" So in other words, look at the hypocrisy there. Paul was on trial for violating the law. And Paul says one sentence, and they violate the law by striking a prisoner who's standing there before them. Now, it's sort of interesting. Now, let's read the next couple of verses. But the bystander said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, where it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" So Paul backs down a little bit, like, uh-oh. He didn't know this was a high priest. nor did he expect the high priest to act in such a way, such a crude way. But it's sort of interesting that even though if Paul had known the high priest, he wouldn't have said that, yet it was almost prophetic, because that particular high priest, Ananias, if he is who scholars think he is, that 5 years from that point, he was, during the beginnings of the Jewish revolt, he was killed. He was hiding in the remains of the ruins of a conduit. He was dragged out and killed. So barely 5 years from now, the guy was killed. So in some sense, he was indeed, he did indeed suffer the judgment of God, because he did not go to his grave dying peacefully at a ripe old age. So now Paul's got a problem. His whole argument, his whole point, was he started off, he had a good conscience before God. And a few seconds later, he made a boo-boo and did something that violated his own conscience, because he himself had to back down from it and say, uh-oh, basically apologize, because he was not aware that he was a high priest. Either he really and truly did not know he was a high priest, which is probably likely. Some people think Paul's eyes weren't the best. And because this was not a formal meeting of the Sanhedrin in the Sanhedrin chambers, but rather a meeting that was convened by the Romans in the fortress of Antonia, chances are very good that the high priest was not sitting in a place of authority and was not dressed in the robes of a high priest. So Paul could, in fact, not have recognized him. So, all right, so the good conscience tactic wasn't going to work anymore. Verse 6. But perceiving that one group was Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit, but the Pharisee acknowledged them all. And there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up, began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose there a spirit or an angel has spoken to him." And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them, and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. Sort of interesting, in modern Christian thinking, we almost consider the Pharisees to be the bad guys, but yet in terms of their thinking between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Pharisees, despite the hypocrisy of their rulers, seem to be the most in harmony with the truth, with the doctrine of Yeshua and the doctrine that Paul was teaching, namely about the resurrection of the body and the existence of the soul and spirits and angels, whereas the Sadducees, who were the priestly class, absolutely did not want to hear that. So it's a good question as whether Paul was doing this to stir the nest, or whether he really thought that he would get success by this, that the Pharisees would prevail, that he would. It seems like he had won over some of the Pharisaic side, in that they were starting to say, could it be that a spirit or an angel did talk to this guy? And maybe what he's teaching isn't all that different than what we believe. But of course, it wound up, the whole thing, just the whole place came unglued. People were, it was turning into a riot, pretty much, so that the commander ordered the troops to march in and pull Paul out of there again, but this time with the full force of the troops. So here, I think Paul was hoping that he could make some inroads among Sanhedrin, but it didn't work out. Verse 11, but on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also." Now, Paul had wanted to go to Rome. I think one of the reasons why he was so interested in Rome was because of the fact of his close association with Priscilla and Aquila, who were originally from Rome and were evicted from Rome when they told the Jews to leave. So I think the stories they told of the community there and the opening there to minister, I don't think there was any, despite, you know, the fairy tales about the Apostle Peter ministering there, I don't think there was any apostolic leadership for the communities at Rome. And so I think Paul wanted to go there because he felt like the community there needed some leadership, needed some discipleship. And so here he's not only getting a encouragement from Yeshua, but encouragement that he was going to wind up in the very place he wanted to go. But the one thing that's kind of not that encouraging is, as you have solemnly witnessed Yeshua's cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. Well, how did he witness in Jerusalem? It didn't sound like he had done much witnessing until he was actually arrested. So it sounded like what Yeshua was saying to him was, yes, you're going to Rome, which is the place you wanted to go. Yes, you're going to solemnly testify to me. That's the good news. Bad news is, you're going to do it from the same kind of place that you are witnessing now, namely for a place of imprisonment in Rome. By the way, scholars are generally of the opinion that Paul was eventually released from this first imprisonment at Rome, that he did have further missionary experiences, and then was arrested again and then put to death. Paul needed this encouragement, verse 12. And it's interesting that God tends to come to us to give us encouragement at the point when we are not just at the end of our rope, but we're at the end of our rope and the rope is fraying. That's at the point when he acts and there is some encouragement because his rope is about to fray. Verse 12, when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. Well, that's certainly a godly way of doing things, right? That God in the Torah never commanded people to take vengeance into their own hands, to form this merry little band of assassination, to go and kill him without a trial. And all this is by people who claim to be doing it because of their zealousness for the law. Verse 14, they came to the chief priests and the elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Presumably they found some loophole so they didn't starve to death, because as we'll see, they were not successful. So hopefully, well, I don't know, hopefully, but you know, one never knows. The rest of the story is not told. Verse 15, now therefore, you and the council notify the commander, bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. And we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. So that was their plan. They are going to notify the commander to bring him down to the Sanhedrin. Maybe they promised that this time they'd make nice and actually, you know, just give a more thorough investigation. But the squad of assassins, their plot was that he would never make it to the Sanhedrin. They would ambush them somewhere along the streets, and that would be that. Verse 16, but the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. We don't hear anywhere else about Paul's family. We don't know what was going on. We know now that he had a sister, and his sister had a son, and his son was there in Jerusalem. We don't know why. We don't know if the son was studying in the academies in Jerusalem, as Paul did, in which case he would have had ample opportunity to hear of this plot. You know, when you have 40 people and high priests and elders involved, good luck keeping it a secret. So somehow the secret found its way to Paul's nephew, and he came and told Paul. Verse 17, Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Leave this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him." So he took him and led him to the commander and said, "Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to leave this young man to you since he has something to tell you." The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, "What is it that you have to report to me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. Do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse, not to eat or drink until they slay him. Now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man go, instructing him, "Tell no one that you have notified me of these things." So the commander wanted them to go ahead and set up the ambush, because if the word had spread that they knew of it, then this assassin squad would think of something else. Verse 23, "And he called him two of the centurions and said, 'Get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen.'" So he was not messing around. He was not messing with this. He had enough of this, of these plots and this counterplot and the council and the riots. He said, "We're going to take a serious force, and we're getting out of here. We're getting out of town." Verse 24, "They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor." So he was done with Jerusalem. He was done with the Sanhedrin. He was done with this problem of this Roman citizen. He was sending him off. Verse 25, "And he wrote a letter having this form: Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings." So now we know the guy's name, Claudius Lysias. He was the commander. "When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman." Well, okay, he polished things a little bit, because he protected him from the Jews, dragged him off, then learned that he was a Roman. But we'll give him this little bit of a polishing of his own reputation. He's making himself look like this valiant Claudius Lysias, who raced in with his soldiers to rescue this poor Roman citizen, yada, yada, yada. Verse 28, "And wanting to ascertain the charge which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you." So, buck pass. "So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. When these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When he had read it, he asked from what province he was. When he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, 'I will give you a hearing after your accusers are alive also,' giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium." So now at least he's out of Jerusalem, out of all the plots and counterplots. He's now back in Caesarea, kind of where he had one of his stopovers on the way. So he's in Caesarea. He's not really under arrest. He's really in protective custody, if you will. But he's back in Caesarea, where he has lots of friends. He has Philip. He has other people in Caesarea. And in the next chapters, when we get to the next few chapters, we'll see that there at Caesarea, since he was in protective custody, his friends and associates could freely come and minister to him. So although it was bad, it was not horrible bad. He didn't have his freedom, but he was still able to stay alive. And scholars differ over which one, if any, of his epistles were written at Caesarea, but people do think that he wrote at least some of his writings at Caesarea at this time when he was under imprisonment. So It was a bad time, but in another sense, Paul was the safest there in Caesarea that he had been for a while. When you look at his career in all the different cities he'd been in, where he'd been beaten and chased and all the rest, it's almost a restful time for him to be under house arrest here, because now he doesn't have all these plots, he doesn't have people coming against him, so he gets to kind of settle in. So God does work in mysterious ways, but it's interesting to see the hypocrisy and the blindness of the people that had brought these charges against Paul. It is as Yeshua said, that they strain out a gnat and swallow a camel, in terms of they were so particular over the smallest aspects of the law, but yet under all these weighty matters, the things that mattered more, the way they treated other people, they were totally and utterly clueless. And we have to watch ourselves to make sure that we don't engage in rank hypocrisy ourselves. It's not something that's confined to the Jewish people. You look at the history of the churches, even nowadays, the ways in which people are acting and reacting. You know, you listen to Christian radio sometime, and some of the ways in which people are acting, but yet they're very, very fastidious about these little matters. But yet, in the great big matters, they are in some ways very, very far away from God. I think, in particular, for an example, is you listen to people, to some preachers and some Christian organizations talk politics, and you think, wow, that ain't very loving from what I can hear. I mean, that isn't very respectful, that isn't very honorable. Other ways in which, you know, we strain out a gnat and swallow the camel in the ways we do. And so we've got to be careful that we don't get, that we have to have that character of our Messiah. And although we can be zealous, and we should be zealous in some ways, that our zealousness should not lead us to do things in ways that are not godly ways, that are ways that even dishonor God and bring disrepute to Him. But rather that everything, from top to bottom, everything, single thing, ought to be lined up with the will and the Word of God and how we practice ourselves. And even if we do that, be prepared for irrational opposition. Irrational opposition, because the opposition of the council against Paul was not rational. It didn't make any sense. It was pure emotion. And we too see times when we are, when the hatred of Messiah comes out for no rational reason. There's no rational reason for it. It's just because, as Yeshua said, people love darkness rather than light. And they will not come out to the light because their deeds are evil. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for the example we have of Paul's courage, even in the midst of danger. I would ask that you also give us courage and wisdom, that we might bring light wherever we go, that we might cause people to glorify you in every aspect of our lives, and that you would reveal to us any blind spots, so that we would not be zealous in one area while discrediting you in another, but that our lives might be completely in balance, and that in every way, no matter it's what we say or what we do, we might glorify your precious name. Amen.